Hello, and welcome to Be Indie Now, a podcast about independent game development. I'm your host, Tobias Marks, and with me today is George Holtgren.
Hi.
George is making a game called Wayward Terran Frontier, right?
Yep.
Tell me about it.
Okay, well, Wayward Terran Frontier is this game that I've wanted to play for ages, probably ever since I was a kid playing Escape Velocity on a Macintosh at my dad's house. It's a game where you can be kind of a space captain of your own spaceship, own your own spaceship, and fly around the universe having adventures, but which is kind of features that existed in the games I played as a kid, except that...
But not like flying in the cockpit where you're, you know, steering a joystick around, more like a top-down management...
Yeah, those games were traditionally 2D, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very top-down, it's very 2D, but you've got the whole inside of your ship, and you can have multiple people in the ship at the same time. So you've got friends kind of walking around inside a ship together, but it's not really focusing entirely on the micromanagement of the ship. It's trying to keep it simple enough so that you can really have like epic space adventures in this big, persistent galaxy.
So would you call it an MMO, or do you think it's like enjoyable single player as well?
I think it's a tendency when I describe it to make it that it sounds like an MMO. A lot of people, I think, they come off with the impression that I'm trying to build an MMO. I think that I do want to have this kind of persistent online world, but I really want it to be kind of more in the direction that, like, a Minecraft server is a persistent online world. I want people to host their own server and kind of maybe even have their own kind of rule set for the server that they're hosting, and then have their friends play with them on that server, and probably not too big.
So do you see people like, oh, let's play a game, and then we'll make a server, and then last for like a week, and then they kill it? Or do you think people will be like, well, this is my server, and people will play on it for months and months?
Yeah, so I'm hoping that you'll have both. The idea is to make the client really integrated with the server. So it's going to be two separate executables, but the idea is that if you want to just kind of play single player, you can have sort of single player server. You just play, you go into the client, click play single player.
Just like in Minecraft, where you kind of have, I have like my server that's for me, and then other people maybe can join in if I wanted to, like locally. But otherwise,
exactly.
Like if I'm, I want to play with my friends, I'll play on their server, or I'll play on online somewhere.
So you can have different shards, and maybe when you play single player, you just it secretly is hosting a server in the background because it's always multiplayer.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't have to really be noticeable. You're just clicking single player and you're playing the game as if...
And it's not necessarily you need online presence either. You can be like hosting on your local client for local network play.
Yeah. But then in addition to just playing single player, I think that, you know, since it is a separate executable, I think there will be people who want to just leave it running on a dedicated server so that their friends can connect at all hours of the day, kind of, you know, log in and check on the status of their space station or...
Is there any persistency with your ship between one server or another that you're planning?
So, there are a lot of decisions to be made in terms of how the profiles that are on the client can be transported between the profiles that are on the server. I think the way I want to do it is that there are all these different ship holes that you can like unlock as you're playing, and those would probably be server-side. So the longer that you play on a specific world, the more of these different ships that you unlock. But the actual insides of those ships, the internal, the walls, the modules, all the stuff that actually makes up the real ship, takes a while to design if you really want to, you know, minimize and maximize all the little bits of it. And so those are probably going to be client-side, which means that when you hop from one server to another server, you might not have unlocked a ship yet on that new server, but you have all your old designs that you've created, so you don't have to like recreate them from scratch.
So if I, you know, had the lesser ship, I'd have my old designs from that ship, and then as soon as I get the newer ship, I've already designed out my ideal newer ship category type. That makes sense.
Yeah. And my hope is that you'll be able to share designs with your friends. I say my hope. I'm going to be the one designing it. I'm going to make it so that you can share designs with your friends,
mm-hmm.
is the idea. So that maybe if you're friend tries to convince you to play on his server, but you've already designed a really cool ship that would be great to fly as a team. Well, you give him that design, he has the budget, he has the ship unlocked, he spawns the ship, you guys fly it together as a team.
So what's preventing me from making a Borg cube with just, you know, maximized amount of space, guns along every side? Like, is that like a good strategy, or are you having something to prevent that, or?
So your character kind of has this budget for how much they're allowed to spend on their ship. And I think that having a massive cube-shaped ship that fills every single pixel of the thing with shields or armor or whatever is probably a viable strategy on some level. But the cost structure tries to incentivize away from that, because every single, you know, pixel that you add onto your big ridiculous cube ship is going to cost you more budget. And so, you know, it might just end up that that ship is too expensive and that someone else with a more cost-efficient design is going to be just as effective.
Well, that's good, but what if, like, okay, I make a smaller Borg cube, right? Like, what incentivizes me to make cool-looking ships? Why would I make a cool hallway or a sleek, you know, space curves, right? Like, obviously, okay, that's not realistic spacecraft, so you might be going for, you know, more realism, but that's what I want to make.
So That's a harder question, because I think what the reality is that it's probably going to be up to the people who are running the server. A lot of people have asked, well, the ship artwork, you know, what determines how the ship actually looks, can I upload whatever I want from my client on whatever server that I'm playing on? Well, the answer to that is probably going to be that the server admins will get to decide. And so I think that what's going to happen is that if you're hosting a server with just your friends, and it's, you know, you and your five buddies have a persistent world together, then it makes sense to have that on, because you know your friends are going to want to do creative things, draw their own ship, that sort of thing. But if you're hosting kind of a public internet-facing server that anyone is allowed to play on, then you're going to run into issues with people trying to upload all sorts of unreasonable things that you might, you know, that will maybe make the game less enjoyable for everyone involved. And so I basically give the person running the server the power to moderate that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't allow people to upload their own artwork for ships onto your server, there's going to be all sorts of artwork built into the game. Like I said, those ship holes that you can unlock are always going to be available to anyone who plays, because they don't have to upload that content.
So what's preventing, like, an ideal design? Like, okay, this is the best three-gun ship. This is the best fast ship. I mean, is it just there's too many different subcategories of ships to be able to have that be the best, or?
Well, I think really what will prevent one ship from being universally better than every other ship is the diversity of the types of content that ships will be used to explore, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, so, like, just give me – you don't have to, like, run through all the mechanics, because obviously the game is in the early development stage.
Yeah.
But besides the obvious guns, missiles, engines, what kind of stuff is going to be in the ship?
Keeping your crew alive, being able to repair a ship that's taken damage. I mean, since this is a game that's very focused on exploration, one of the biggest challenges that you're going to be facing, in addition to trying to blow up a other ship all the time, is that you're going to be trying to, you know, get to places that are hard to get to, whether because they're far away or because people are chasing you while you try to get there, or maybe there's some weird space anomaly that interferes with parts of your ship. So If one ship has – I've seen lots of people, and it's fun to make this type of thing, you know, make a ship that has nothing but guns and generators, and it can fire, like, crazy fast. And, you know, it's fun when you're just shooting AI and testing with the client that exists right now, but what I've seen is that these things tend to, you know, have no shields, no structure, no life support. If they take a couple hits, suddenly.
And so you start getting that utility in. It's like, yeah, you can make a gun glass cannon ship, but you're not really going to have that as your ship because you need all this other extra stuff to really enjoy the game.
Yeah, it was like this big, giant, deadly, super gun battleship that would still crumble if you hit it a couple times, and so it wasn't really something you'd want to take into
But it's cool that you have that diversity where, like, okay, if that's what you want to do, like, if you want to have this... Actually, it's a good question. Do you have multiple ships in the game? Like, can I hop from one ship to another? Like, I'm going to hop in my glass cannon shit and fire you up and then go back to my other ship.
Yeah, so... When I first kind of envisioned this project, there was a tendency to think of the ship as the main character for this sort of RPG. And I think that's because, you know, the games that it's based off of, like Escape Velocity, like I said, where the ship really was your main character. More and more as I developed it, I was doing things like letting ships break into two pieces and still be two separate ships after that point. You know... From a design standpoint, you have to start to make a decision that, okay, maybe the ship isn't the character. Maybe your character, the crew member, is your character. And so what that means is that while your character is going to have the ability to spawn your ship into the world, and when it gets blown up, respawn it into the world, it's not necessarily... going to confine you to that ship as if that ship was your character. Mm-hmm. I envision people will... The main way that you get from one ship to another is you dock them together and you just walk through the airlock. So if you want to play with your friend, you're going to have to meet up with them somewhere in the world, dock with them, walk onto their ship, and then fly off and have adventures. Odds are when you do that, you're just going to leave your ship behind. Then the question is, does it stay in the world for a while? Maybe will someone
else... park it somewhere that you remember where it's left?
So,
could someone else steal it?
Yeah. So I really like the idea of people being able to steal your ship. I was kind of... I toyed around with that idea
for a bit. You have a castle doctrine where you have to have a security system.
Yeah. And certainly you as a player can steal NPC ships. So if an NPC character really doesn't interact with the world too differently from your character, then maybe other players could steal your ship.
Yeah, and that, like, Minecraft seems like a server-based thing, because there's PvP Minecraft servers where people are trying to, like, build fortresses from each other.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
Other people just want to play together.
And I could see people complaining about that on the forums, and then I'll have to be like, okay, let's rethink this. And the solution that I'll end up eventually settling on, I'm almost certain of, is, you know, make it an option that the server administrator
chooses. Yeah, just a checkbox that they can click, can you steal other players' stuff?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that seems like a simple solution.
Yeah.
So what about, you know, having, like, the Enterprise where... Like the Enterprise D, I'm thinking of where you have the saucer section and the main body. So you're like, you detach. You have two different ships. Like, can I get my friend to pilot, you know, both halves? Can I get an NPC to, like, autopilot one half?
So I don't have a decoupler module in the game right now. But aside from that, there's no mechanic that would prevent that. I mean, you can. So I. One of my favorite ships to show off in the videos is the Hydra, because it's kind of got these three separate heads to it. Mm-hmm. And the way I laid out the ship in my design was I put, like, you know, one of every piece in each portion of the ship, so that if you shoot one of the sections off the ship, it becomes a full ship by itself. If all I would have to do from, you know, a technical standpoint is add some type of decoupler module that could be activated, split the ship into two pieces, and yeah, now you have the saucer section.
And that could be really useful. It's like, you know, this big ship comes in and then it splits off into three little ships, and they're much harder to hit because they're smaller.
Yeah.
That's like more work for you, right? It's like, oh, if you had an extra $10,000 on my Kickstarter, hit the stretch goal.
Actually, I don't think that would... that mechanic is kind of in there. To give you an example, one of my artists, Josh Hanna, who's been making a lot of the ship artwork, he thought that mechanic was really cool. And one of the ships that I just recently added into the game, he said, hey, you know, I want to experiment. I want to play around with this mechanic. So he made a ship that is actually one ship, but it looks like a whole bunch of little ships connected with like thin posts into a main ship, so that if you want, you can design it such that, you know, as it's taking damage, it breaks into smaller pieces. The smaller pieces are then just become more ships you have to deal with.
So do you have AI at this point where I can, you know, say auto attack? smaller ships? Because if you have like 10 modules, you kind of hard to manage as a player.
Oh, yeah. Oh, no. So the AI in that scenario is definitely autonomous. The AI isn't very smart, but it has a faction alignment. It knows whose side it's on. And if you kind of tell your crew member guy to go off onto the right side of the ship and then the ship gets split in half, he's going to be like, oh, crud, I'm in my own new ship now. And he knows that he's your ally because, you know, same faction. He knows he's in a ship by himself, so he will do his best to take over the ship and fly it. And you don't have any direct control over him, but he will, you know, go off and attack your enemies. And
you have, what about, like, communication modules to be able to give him orders?
Yeah, and then
it's a lot of possibilities for stuff you can add.
Yeah, I can foresee a whole slew of really interesting bugs coming up too. Like,
oh yeah, no, the testing that this is going to be very, very hard
because you know, one of the things I want to do is travel long distances across the universe. So if you're going to set autopilot, you're not going to set autopilot by commanding the ship. You're going to set autopilot by commanding the crew. You're going to set a waypoint, and then you're going to leave the console, and the crew is going to pick it up and be like, oh, hey, I guess we need to be flying to this place, and they're going to start flying the ship. You know, but what happens if you have a waypoint, and then the ship gets split into five pieces? Are you going to have to chase down those five pieces and be like, wait, don't leave without me, sort of thing?
Yeah, and, like, what defines it as yours, you know, because then it gets like, well, I took over a portion of your ship.
Yeah, so there's
a hostile takeover. Is it mine now? Is it yours?
There's definitely a lot of strange edge scenarios to consider when I'm designing this, but for the most part, when little pieces break off of your ship, there is one piece that kind of remains the main piece.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right, so let's reel it back a little bit.
Okay. Like,
when did you start this project?
Oh, man. It was a couple years ago. I was actually working full-time, and I had an agreement in my employment contract that said I was kind of allowed to do my own project. I was just in IT at the time. I was doing support stuff. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, I worked with a bunch of geeks, and we loved these space games. We'd played almost everything in the genre, and it got, I mean, it was to the point where we'd go out to lunch together almost every day, and we had to be really cautious that nobody started an argument about, like, Star Trek or something, because it would get really loud and obnoxious. And then everyone in the restaurant was kind of looking at those kids that were yelling about Star Trek.
They were like, no, Picard was the best.
Oh, yeah. They could. Those two, my two friends had every episode of Star Trek memorized, and it was fun. But one of the things we would talk about is the game that we wanted to play, the space game that we would want to play, and I've honestly been working with little space games and toying with programming since long 10 years ago, college era, when, I mean, it was the first program I ever wrote was a little space RPG type game, so I've always had these ideas bouncing around in my head, but it was when I had, you know, afternoons and evenings and, you know, I had friends at work that were always talking about the features they wanted to see that I just kind of started putting it together as a hobby. And so it's built.
So, like, 2 years ago you started putting it together, or 2 years ago you started talking about it?
Actually, I remember exactly what caused me to sit down and start programming it. When I saw it was Notch, creator of Minecraft, mm-hmm. when I saw his announcement about the, I guess it's the Trellick project now, but it was Zero10XC back then, when he announced, oh, hey, you know, there's this game that needs to be made, this game with people walking around in spaceships and having multiplayer adventures online together in a persistent world, you know, he said, I remember specifically the webpage that he put up that was just kind of a boilerplate page. It said, you know, someone needs to make this game, and I guess, you know, maybe it'll be me, maybe it won't be me, but I'm going to toy around for a bit and try to make it. And I remember thinking to myself the day I read that, I said, it's going to be me. And I sat down, and I had played around with XNA a lot. I had made so many game prototypes, but I had lots of ideas of kind of how I wanted to do certain things. And I remember thinking that I had done kind of per-pixel collisions in XNA before, and that was pretty easy, and that there were great tutorials. And so I'm like, I bet I could do per-pixel destruction. And I tried it, and it worked, and I just started writing up design documents from there, and it just all came together.
Yeah, it's funny that the stretching is one of the core things, because, like, just talking about the game, we naturally evolve into, like, talking about ships breaking apart and doing weird stuff, and that's not normally where your discussion goes when talking about a space game.
Yeah.
But it's that kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, Minecraft element, where you have that creation and destruction of things, where you're building them together and breaking them apart. It's what, in my opinion, makes it unique. Like, well, how would you say your game is different than, you know, other things? Like, a lot of people will see it and say, well, how's it different than FTL? Like, you know, I saw a play prototype, I saw the video. I know intrinsically it's different than FTL, yeah. But I want to hear you describe how.
Oh, how's it different? Well, it feels like no matter which gameplay element I think of, there is some game that has something that's at least a little similar. But as far as I can tell, there isn't really a game that allows you to... well, no, there are games that allow you to have kind of a voxel ship... and design your own ship. Those games don't quite have the physics of the inside of the ship, of, like, you know, atmosphere sucking out of crew management.
Yeah, it's not that you've done something so radically different.
You know what I think I would have to say it is? It's the emphasis on RPG gameplay elements. A lot of there's a lot of people right now that are building... ship design and voxel-based ship simulators. But I kind of have built my game as an RPG from the beginning. It was designed like an RPG. I think of it as an RPG. It really is about a character and character progression and the story of the world.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up the story, too, because you mentioned a lot in your Kickstarter about these story elements that you use. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I just did a big update to the Kickstarter that was about the lore, because a number of people have asked me, but also because I have this crazy kind of space epic story that I've wanted to tell for a very long time, and I'm not the best at writing, obviously. If I, like I've said online and such, if I was a novelist, I wouldn't, you know, I would have written this already. It's kind of a story about this crazy artificial intelligence that is enslaving humans, but it acts kind of illogically. It doesn't act the way you'd expect all that your typical crazy artificial. I don't know. It's kind of a trope at this point to have an artificial intelligence that's gone insane.
But do you see the story as, like, you'll write a progression and people will experience it in their own light, or more like, you know, it's an MMO style where there's quests and there's kind of this overall story. Like, World of Warcraft has a strong story, but it's not like a linear story. It's there's stuff in the world.
It's very much it's an open world that lets you explore, but every time you talk to an NPC, every time you... Yeah, and I think basically something like that. The story that I have envisioned, actually, if you can imagine it as three books, the first two books are all just kind of backstory, stuff that has happened prior to the events of this game that you will learn about while exploring. You'll meet characters that talk about it. You'll find clues in the wreckage of ships that you explore, and, you know, in war-ravaged planets that you go to, you'll maybe find some hint or some clue as to what has happened in the past. But in the present... and it's kind of hard to talk about the lore because, like I said, I approach the game first and foremost from the standpoint of being an RPG. And that means, like, the mechanics that I've seen in role-playing games that make role-playing games really addictive. But a lot of my ideas about the project as a whole kind of... don't agree with each other because they see the project from a different perspective. Or rather, they do agree with each other, but only because the project exists. If that doesn't make any sense. I guess what I mean is the lore that I've built around the character that you play and the story that your character has ties directly into the role-playing elements, because I want your character's story to be about why is it that we find these role-playing games so fun in the first place?
So, like, to give you an example from your Kickstarter video, you talked about how I'll be searching around and you'll find a distress call and you might save a ship and you find some data. And then because you have that data, that'll trigger other quests of, like, pirates trying to get that. And it's like, oh, why does this matter?
Yeah.
And so it's kind of dynamically generating the story that's unique to me as a player, and I could talk to, you know, someone else playing it and say, oh, I found this data, and then these people are added, and you kind of piece together a story that way.
Yeah.
Is that a better way to describe it?
So that's two elements of it, and they're two completely separate elements that I want to have at the same time. So I guess from a technology standpoint, yes, I'm building a system that's going to allow these sort of procedural dynamic events to tell the story. So you're not going to be starting off with a primary quest line, and then, you know, you go to waypoint
and
one.
And it's going to be a lot better than making people read, like, just a paragraph of space stuff with, you know, AI. You're not going to get anybody reading it.
Exactly. And big part of that is because I'm probably the world's worst RPG gamer. I've watched the way I play RPGs, and I'm the guy who's like, yeah, blah, blah, quest text, get to the point where I bash the monkeys over the head and get the rewards. Like, I just skip through all of that stuff, and I just try to go off and do whatever it takes to kind of grind my character to the maximum level. I guess what I'm saying is, when I play these games, I'm more interested in just the mechanics of the RPG, the numeric representation of my character getting stronger, the new weapon that I might potentially use that would make me hit a little harder, whatever it is. There's something to those actual mechanics that has a psychological effect on me that makes me enjoy the game. Well, that's why the main story in the game is about this artificial intelligence that is controlling humans by having them play their life as if it were an RPG. So there's all these RPG elements for your character. You can improve your character, you can go on adventures and get loot. The computer rewards you for the types of things that you might do in an RPG. But for your character, that's real life. This sort of artificial intelligence has turned your character's life into a role-playing.
You're trying to go like a weird metagame with a story.
Kind of.
It's very interesting. I definitely will have to, like, all of it's about implementation, right?
Yes.
Like, no matter how much you talk about it, it's how that story gets implemented which will make it good or bad. Because video game stories are very finical like that. You can have an incredibly interesting, well-written story that means nothing when it's in a game, or a game with a pretty bland story that's, like, amazing. I'm telling all my friends about how great the story was because of the way it was presented.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm hoping that I'll be able to do with the funds from the Kickstarter is get some voice acting, so that this, you know, artificial intelligence character that kind of controls your interaction with the whole world, for the most part, can have a real personality that comes through to the player and can help the player understand the world they're in and why they're doing the things that they're doing.
So, speaking of the Kickstarter, how much are you asking for?
I'm asking for $50,000.
All right. So how did you come up with that figure? What are you going to use it for? Why 50,000? Why not 20? Why not 100?
A lot of factors. $50,000 is based first and foremost on – so I spent – when I first started doing this project full-time, I quit my job and I had a certain amount of savings saved up. And, you know, part one of the plan was, hey, okay, I have, you know, however much money that was in my bank account at the time. I said, we're going to sit down, we're going to see how long this lasts, for one. And for two, if I'm contracting at what I consider to be a slow rate, getting small amounts of content, getting, you know, a sound effect here, some art there, and then just spending most of my time doing nothing but development with a little bit of publicity, you know, A, how fast do I burn through funds? And part of it also was I had to go and find, like, the cheapest place I could live. I had to see if I could live off of nothing but ramen noodles, that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's rough when you're trying to, like, factor in, like, oh, I can get this much. Oh, wait, I need my own food.
Yeah.
I guess I could live off of this much, but...
Well, one of the things I have strongly considered is if the Kickstarter is successful, I'll probably have to consider moving out of the Bay Area, because if I move just 300 miles away, I can, you know, the cost of living, which honestly is a very small portion of what the Kickstarter is going to, but that goes down drastically.
Yeah, I mean, well, there's kind of a pro and con living here in the Bay Area because, yeah, you'll be cheaper elsewhere, but here is where all the companies are. Here's where all the connections are, especially when you've gone to promoting your game. You can just go to different, you know, I don't know, you're probably not going to have ads in your game, but, you know, just definitely.
It's
all of the major tech companies are here. All the industry is here. All the platforms you're going to release to is here.
Yeah, we live in a magical wonderland of technology and startups. It's absolutely the best place to live if you want to meet people and do exciting new things. But it's also one of the – it's very fast.
Yeah, it'll cost you. It comes with a price. The cost of living here is ridiculous.
It's way too expensive to live here.
So is it – just you won the game with a couple side contractors, or you want to get more people in? Or?
So I've worked with four people. One of those people
including
was...
including yourself or four other people?
Four people other than myself. I've worked with two artists and two sound groups. If you've... the most recent was Chris made the music for the trailer, and I think that we're going to definitely be working together to make more music. A lot of the sound effects was from Bombardier Studios. They're great people. And then Josh Hanno and Khalif Steele, I've worked with them on and off for a long time to make most of the art that you can see in the client right now. All these contacts are people that I want to keep working with, but on a much bigger scale. But then on top of that... when you start doing a Kickstarter and, you know, you spend all day every day trying to talk to the press, do interviews, that sort of thing, you meet all sorts of new people, too. What I have in terms of a budget is a list of the assets that need to go into the game in terms of sound effects, music, art, all the different, you know, like... just drawing a space station and designing the interior of it, because in my game you actually have to have the interior.
Yeah, it's all that extra little polished stuff that is not only extra work to do, but it takes a skill to be able to do that well.
Yes,
because there's a difference between something that works and something that's good.
Yeah, definitely, exactly. And at this point, I've pretty much, aside from writing, worked with worked through the whole process of. You know, having an asset that I need to get, talking to a bunch of candidates, considering different aspects of, you know, different people's skills, and working with someone to contract, you know, from start to finish the whole process and getting it into the game and making sure that it actually works in the game and, you know, keeping track of.
So how much resolution did you budget out? Did you say, okay, I probably will need this many thousands for sound guys, this many thousands for that, and then that will equal the, like, $40,000 you get from a $50,000 Kickstarter or something?
So I have... So basically, the Kickstarter and its fees, they're going to... Amazon... and Kickstarter are going to take like $5,000. I want to put
The rewards fulfillment.
So, the rewards fulfillment, I've gone mostly digital, but I want to talk about. Well, okay, maybe I can't talk about that because I'm still working out a contract in terms of music, and that's actually the reason. My next update, I want to basically itemize my budget in my next update, and I haven't done that yet because. There's one contract that I want to work out before I...
But you are thinking about it. Even if you don't have a finished itemized budget, you're working on one.
Oh, yeah. I know basically how much money I'm going to put into music, how much money I'm going to put into art. I mean, I know. I have a list of, okay, I need, you know, a space station of this size, a space station of that size, this many ships, this many backdrops, this many planets, this many levels designed, this many dialogues written. And because... I have an example of the full I have multiple examples for most of those of like how much it costs, how much time goes into it, how much effort is involved. $50,000 was basically, it's probably not a low estimate. Like I'm certain I can do it for $50,000. In other words, because I guess what I would say is I feel like a lot of people on Kickstarter kind of try to lowball the system. They know that if they ask for less, it's easier to get their project approved. I don't want to be in that position, and that's I feels like I'm asking for a lot, and I know I'm asking for a lot, but at the same time, if I don't get that amount.
Yeah, I mean, if you only get 35 after all those fees, you might not have enough to finish.
Yeah, I looked at what was there, and I came to the conclusion, okay, if I only get 35, then, you know, have to move out of the Bay Area, have to eat, you know, ramen, then maybe I can't do music, but I really want to have music, so maybe I have to, so, like, what do I have to cut out of my, and the truth is I want to add a lot more than $50,000 worth of content to this game.
Yeah, ideally it'll go well and above.
Yeah, absolutely. But there's kind of a point in the project's lifespan where it's got enough content in it that you can release it and have it be big and exciting. And here's the other big point is if when it releases, even if it's when the closed beta releases, if it isn't polished enough, if there isn't enough content in it to keep people interested for a long time, then there won't be a really big, persistent online community of people playing it. And so the people who do pick up the game and try it won't have other people to play with. And so I'm kind of imagining there's this critical mass of the amount of content that I really need to put into the server. Well, technically it's put into the client because that's what's rendering the content, but the amount of content that I need to create.
So why go with Kickstarter in the first place, right? Like, Minecraft wasn't a Kickstarter project. It just started being available and updating over time, and it's really hard to replicate that. You can't say, well, why don't you just do what Notch did? Because, like, you know, FU is not going to work that way. No. But why not do, you know, a different kind of release cycle where you're having people pay over time or pay for tiers or, you know, some other drive other than the traditional, like, waterfall Kickstarter, get all your money at once, spend it in.
Well, there's two reasons that I can see. One, Minecraft example doesn't fit very well for me because the voxel sort of, you know, add and remove blocks is, it's a simple enough core mechanic programmatically that you can produce something that's fun to play for pretty much everyone in a very short period of time. And Notch did. He released Minecraft extremely early. I played like the first version. It was something that you could play in a web browser, and it was, I think there were three block types, so three different colors basically, and it was, you know, right click remove, left click add, no other rules whatsoever, sort of environment. And so he was able to get that out there really fast, and it was, you know, wow, building three-dimensional structures online with friends is really cool. The sort of multiplayer inside your spaceship genre is a much more complicated program to write. I've talked with people when I first announced this project, and you know, the first response I got from a bunch of people was, "Wow, good luck! I tried to build that, and it was too hard, and I gave up."
Definitely you need kind of money for this kind of game and this kind of scope. Yeah. But why not, you know, doing the pre-release thing, seeking an investor, any other number of ways of funding that you could get, you know, getting sponsored by some other company or technology?
Well, I don't know. I don't like the sound of those ideas. I don't want to borrow money. I hate borrowing money. And the other big one, even more than not borrowing money, because then, you know, the idea of having someone who you owe your project to, someone that maybe has thinks that they have creative control over what you're doing, can be very disruptive when you're trying to do something as crazy and as ambitious as what I'm doing.
So it's better to kind of yield that to the majority of, like,
Kickstarter funders. The people that are out there on Kickstarter are the people that, you know, are like me, that played this game and for 20 or 30 bucks would absolutely love to see it created. I don't know. The other thing is because it's the sci-fi genre, so that's the reason number two. Because I'm in sci-fi, it's kind of a niche a genre. It's not something that's easy to pitch to a publisher. It really isn't.
So who is the target audience for this? So you imagine it's just those hardcore space nuts, Star Trek nerds, or do you see this being accessible to a wider audience?
I absolutely want it to be accessible to everyone. Right now, I think it's not because, you know, what I have is a tech demo. I don't have a game. And the ship designer is really – it's really something that's great for the gamer that likes to minimize and maximize everything. It's, you know, and there are gamers that are like that. I'm one of those gamers. But that's, in my experience, kind of a minority percentage of the population. I think that most people, for instance, wouldn't want to spend all their time worrying over the placement of conduits in some spaceship. I think that they want to go in and play a more casual, more accessible game. And so I have a whole lot of ideas of how to make it more accessible. A lot of them are server-side is the thing. Things like, you know, all the ships that exist having pre-made designs so that when you pick up a new ship, you don't have to go and just start with this blank, empty canvas and try to figure out how the rules
work. You have a couple templates to start with.
Yeah, I mean, in previous versions of this style of game, when you're upgrading to a new ship, it just works out of the box. Usually it even comes with guns equipped to it. Like, you can just go and say, man, I really want to have, you know, that better ship, and then buy it and jump into it and fly it. Like, but I also want to have other gameplay elements that are less hardcore, too. I think that people in the sci-fi genre range all over the spectrum from, you know, the guy who wants to really get into the ship engineering and build the world's most complicated ship and see if he can make it slightly faster or slightly more powerful. But there's also the guy who wants to log in the afternoon and just do some trade runs and see if he can make some space monies. And I can definitely see myself wanting to just log in for a couple minutes every now and then, check on the status.
You want that hardcore player to coexist with the casual player.
Yeah. Yeah, and
it's a really hard balance to make that work.
And, it's a hard balance to make that work, but it's also you have to recognize that even the hardcore player these days probably has times when he just doesn't feel like playing a hardcore game.
Yeah, hardcore doesn't mean that, oh, well, hardcore equals they have an infinite amount of time.
Yeah, and I've seen this transition in myself where I used to be a hardcore gamer, drink a Red Bull and stay up for 48 hours straight doing a raid boss.
Yeah, but honestly, you used to be younger, right?
Yeah,
like, we all used to be younger.
Yeah,
and
that's...
Like, there's a hardcore gamer. You could be a hardcore gamer and just not have time anymore. And that's the thing where I look at like a JRPG and it's like, oh, 100-hour investment. Well, can I get the abridged version? Like, I really want to play that game and, you know, see the story and play the stats, but I want to play it for 20 hours, not 100.
Yeah. I see myself getting older and becoming, you know, this negative Nancy sort of like, I don't want to play an MMO. It takes too long. And so because I'm like, I remember myself being the one type of gamer, but I'm becoming the other type of gamer. I'm not going to be able to play this game if it's not made more accessible myself, because I find myself, you know, having anxiety about opening a game that's going to be full screen, because then I know I'm committed for multiple hours, and I'd rather just kind of browse Reddit and click on Netflix and play a game at the same time without really focusing too much attention on any of them, because sometimes I'm just feeling lazy like that.
Yeah, and I think what's different now is that that kind of gamer exists. Like, before, you had to be hardcore to really get into certain kinds of games, but there's been a lot more thought in making games accessible, making games more open. That's one of the reasons why Facebook games exploded.
Yeah.
Is that reason you're just talking about, is people could just kind of play casually, and people realize that, wow, like, there's a whole lot of people who would love to play games if you give them the opportunity to.
Yeah. Yeah, games really, I mean, if you think about it, that we are the first generation to really get to have so many of us get to this age and just remember having spent so much time playing games as kids, you know, previous generations.
Yeah, because like other people grew up with games, but I don't know. There's probably a little bit before our generation grew up with games, because it kind of doesn't matter if they didn't have, you know, games around like six, right? But
yeah.
Games were mature when we were growing up,
yes.
Right? Like they were a bit more polished, there's a bit more variety, there's a bit more kinds of them.
I always tell people, ours is going to be the first generation of old people homes that have Xboxes and PlayStations instead of, you know, Scrabble and backgammon.
Yeah, of course. Like that's just obvious. I mean, I somewhat doubt that because I think we're going to be moving towards digital consoles, but we'll be playing, you know, Final Fantasy VII on my, like, you know, glasses or whatever, yeah. Right?
Okay,
but, like,
Grandma.
We'll play those games, but they'll be emulated through something else. Yeah. We probably won't have an OG system. Original Nintendos, they still work around now, but I'm not confident they're going to work 20, 30 more years.
In my day, we played our video games on a console, damn it.
Yeah.
We had a TV.
All right. So, okay. Summary here. You've been working on the project for years now. You're in the
about
2 years. You're in the middle of your Kickstarter, your big funding campaign.
Yep.
I give you a time machine. What do you say to yourself 2 years ago?
Oh, that's a tough one. What do I say to myself if I had a time machine 2 years ago?
Even if it's just like what lesson that you learned, what mistake that you made that you would not repeat?
Actually, if I had a time machine 2 years ago, I'd just give myself this thumb drive in my pocket.
Yeah.
That would make everything so much easier.
Yeah, okay. Let's go with a literal question here, right? Like, what's the spear here? What advice would you give yourself? What mistakes have you made? Or things that you did right, like something that, man, that was such a good decision. Don't doubt yourself. That was the way to go.
That's a tough question. I wish I had more time to think about that question. I think that, for one, I would have told myself to have more faith in this awesome story that I was thinking about, because at the time I was already tossing around the idea of this story that is kind of becoming the lore of my game. But for the longest time, that story only existed on little, you know, a post-it note here and there. And I never really told it to anyone or tried to write out the details because I hadn't told it to anyone before. And I thought, oh, you know, maybe people think it's kind of silly. But, you know, over the years, I've slowly, like, gone to a friend and be like, okay, here's the story that I'm thinking about. You know, tell me what you think. And I've gotten positive response. And I think if I had had that positive response from future self way back then I would have been a lot more confident in the project, and I probably would have honestly been doing...
Was that just a matter of, like, making it real sooner, telling people about it sooner?
Yeah, I mean, it's that transition of, oh, yeah, it's a good idea, but I don't know if I could ever do it, to, yeah, you're doing it in the future, and it's working, so why not just look into it a little earlier, take it more seriously?
Yeah, like, release early and often. I'm always preaching on the show, like, whenever you can, prototype something out, get an idea out there, have an idea, tell somebody else about it. Like, if it's staying in your head, that's not where it should be. Like, good things don't happen for ideas that are brewed on for a while.
Oh, yeah. Well, and then also, I really respond well to feedback. I've had, a long time ago, I was thinking the project was just kind of silly and small, so I released some videos and an alpha version for people to play with, and people messaged me. They're like, the hell's wrong with you? Why haven't you set up forums? Like, we want to talk about this. I'm like, oh, I hadn't even imagined it would be that popular. Mm-hmm. So I set up forums, and people came on the forums and told me what was wrong with my game, and it was exciting.
Yeah, people like beta testing software. People like being part of that process. So if you just tell them, like, hey, I'm a guy, I'm making this, I'm experimenting with it, they don't like, yo, this game is a half complete, one star. They like actually say, oh, hey, I found this bug over here. Oh, could you add this feature? This would make it great.
Yeah. No, I've definitely had, I met someone on the internet that I chat with for a day, and I tell them, you know, try it out. And they're like, okay, I'll give it a try. And then I meet them in the same Google Hangout 24 hours later, and they're like, oh my god, I've been playing your game this whole time. Here's everything I found that's wrong with it. And it's not... I don't take it as an insult. It's like, oh.
No, like, here's what's wrong with it, and like, yes, you can fix this, and we can make it the most awesome game ever kind of way. It's a very positive thing.
Yeah, to me, it's like, oh my... Like, you played my game for 24 hours? wow, I better get back to programming. I feel really embarrassed that something was wrong in the first place.
Yeah, that's really inspiring when you start having that kind of, like, people being affected by your game, even if it was just like, yeah, I devoted some of my time to it and enjoyed it.
Yeah, every time someone tells me that they spent the last 15 hours playing single player and they want multiplayer to be less buggy, like, it makes, you know, my heart run faster because I'm like, oh my god, there's people playing my game and it's not working perfectly. I have to go fix it. And but at the same time, it's like, it's almost,
it shows that you have something there, right? You have the seed, yeah, that can grow into something big and awesome, and you know you're getting that feedback.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. So I always like to end every show not just talking about, you know, the games that you're working on, but games you're playing, because, you know, you have to play games to really know games, right? We're talking about, like, different examples, this information you even mentioned before, that there's some other game that's done some other mechanic, and what you make something interesting is you try other stuff. For me, I actually didn't play video games this week, but because I was out playing with a bunch of friends, and I played a bunch of board games, and I was trying a bunch of new ones. I'm a huge board gamer. Everyone knows me, knows I'm always have board games in my car, always playing them. I played The Resistance Avalon for the first time. I was a fan of The Resistance before. It's kind of like, you know, werewolves or mafia, those kind of games where, like, a couple people are, like, bad guys and everyone else is a good guy and you're trying to figure out who's who, like a big social party game.
Oh, okay.
So it's like that, but with rules that make it so they don't have any player elimination, because the sucky part of those games,
yeah,
is you get 10 people and then the first round somebody dies and they just got to wait until the next round, because it's all about, like, killing everybody off until there's one player left.
Could write a whole study on game design elements right
yeah,
there, right?
Yeah, exactly. It Resistance does it takes that mechanic but makes it so the game continues on by sending people on missions. This was the Avalon version of it, which was medieval, so there's, like, Merlin characters and the assassin characters, and so you could kill off all the bad guys, but then if the bad guys know who Merlin is at the end, it can win. It's a very interesting board game. I'd highly recommend it to people out there. It's also an indie board game, too, so it counts as an indie game, even yeah, though it's not a digital game, or there's not any digital version that I'm aware of.
Both of those words are accurate.
Yeah. What about you? What kind of games have you been playing?
So, like you, I haven't been playing a lot of games this week because, you know, I've been running a Kickstarter, but when I want to kill a couple hours, I go into League of Legends because a lot of my friends are on there all the time. And I was always a fan of Dota back in the day. From a multiplayer balance perspective, I really like what they've done with basically designing the game around incomparables, designing a game that's balanced on the principle that no individual character is balanced, but no individual character is more unbalanced than, you know, some other character that counters it, sort of thing. You can't compare.
Yeah,
the
it all
things.
Kind of works in the soup that is
yeah,
all the characters.
If you make the soup dense enough of with different mechanics, there's never going to be a character that is universally overpowered because.
Well, I mean, there can really like well, there's can be something yeah, that floats to the top of that soup pretty easily. It takes a lot of work to make that yeah, okay, soup kind of float in that range.
But you know, a game that I would play a long, long time ago would be like an MMO. Like, I played World of Warcraft and Burning Crusade, mm-hmm, and that had the opposite balancing problem. If you had people going into arena, and the people would complain, oh, this character does, you know, more damage with burst attacks, and it's unfair because I need that utility, and they start, since there really is comparable statistics for everything that you do, over time, the balance moves in the direction of making everything the same.
Yeah, and so a lot of the characters kind of become a different flavor, same thing.
And that's what I felt happened in that area. But you know, League for me and Dota at the time, because that was back then, it was just great because there was always some new mechanic to try around with, and the new mechanics didn't have to be, you know, a carbon copy of an older mechanic. But I also like playing, like I said, I play a lot of casual games. I don't have a lot of time between development to really be invested in a long sort of, you know, involved game. And so I played recently Risk of Rain. Mm-hmm. I really like that game. something very satisfying about having 800 million things on the screen all trying to stomp you to death and shooting little bolts everywhere. And there's huge diversity of awesome items that you can collect. And
yeah, also a good, like, in-depth strategy game. So yeah. You got a lot of inspiration from that.
Actually, a lot of roguelikes in general. I think the term roguelike is being thrown around in the industry a lot. The original Rogue was kind of an ASCII art-based game about exploring dungeons. So when you're getting all the way to describing a game like FTL as being a roguelike, yeah, somewhere the line got a little blurrier.
Right? I mean, they used to call first-person shooters Doom clones, right?
Yeah.
We don't have the vernacular to define the genre better than that. It's like we're calling everything about creation and building Minecraft-like.
Yeah,
exactly. And like, Minecraft is very specific, and I guess Lego games are, you know, to have Minecraft-like elements are more similar, but pretty much after that it starts getting kind of weird. Like EverQuest Next, I forget what it's called.
EverQuest Next.
Yeah, it has a lot of Minecraft-like elements.
Yeah, that game looks exciting to me. I like the idea of being able to go out into the middle of one of these maps and then just dig straight down, and the idea that...
Yeah, I mean, I love that back in like a Red Faction days. You remember that like crappy first-person shooter that was like basically the reason why you played it is that you could just go with a rocket launcher and dig giant holes for no reason, but that was fun.
Yeah. I am really glad that the entire industry is just fascinated by voxels.
Mm-hmm.
I'm glad because from an algorithm standpoint, it's a great way to make a multiplayer deformable world in the sense that hasn't really existed before. Big, massive multiplayer games with lots of people always had to have static worlds because the problem of being able to put changeable things into a world with lots of people that might see those changeable things is you get unbounded potentials of information flow.
Yeah, that just from technical reasons, just was not possible to consider.
And people asked, why can't you drop an item on the ground in World of Warcraft? Right, you could do it in Diablo 2.
Yeah, no, it would just be like already just weird spawning issues with your pet and stuff.
Right? Oh, yeah.
They're mostly worked out because it's basically tied to you as a character, but you imagine the ghosting and lag and the drift that you get.
Infinite loading screens as people throw items on the ground faster than you can download their names of the items.
Oh, yeah. You could just like crash the game if you do that too much.
But the voxel, because it has sort of like, you know, fixed locations for a block to be, and the block is either there or not there, it puts this sort of it puts a maximum cap on the total amount of data that the world can hold. And so long as there's that maximum cap, if your network can handle the information about that cap, then
It literally puts it in a box, so it becomes definable and actually somewhat reasonable to make. It's definitely a very, very exciting time to be making games.
Yeah, I love all the new voxel games coming out.
Cool stuff. So if you want to find more about me, you can go to my website, tobiamarks.com, or find me on Twitter, @tobiamarks. You can find out the game. It's Wayward Terran Frontier on Kickstarter. Where you have a website?
Yeah, my website is wtfrontier.com. I think Wayward Terran Frontier is a little long for obvious reasons, so wtfrontier.com. And of course, there's the forums there too, which is where people are sharing all their spaceship creations. And
you have a Twitter account too?
Yeah, I'm a Alloginist on Twitter.
Oh, you'll probably have to spell that.
Alloginist.
Perfect.
I had to make up my own word because everything else was taken.
Oh yeah, I know that story. But that becomes hard to find people, right? Like, how do you spell that again? So
my original screen name, and I still use this screen name on a lot of places. It was Splad, but I don't use that anymore because it's not unique. It was given to me as...
you need some SEO mojo when you make your game now. So you have to research that.
Yeah.
Very, very cool. Highly recommend you guys looking at it. I'm going to make sure this episode comes out next week, so there'll still be a couple weeks left in the Kickstarter if you want to back it. If it hasn't been fully funded by then. George, thank you very much for coming on the show and talking about your game. And everyone out there, go out there and make some games.
Cool. Thanks.